Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The healthcare reform bullies find themselves a new pulpit.
Show me what you got.
We didn't come here just to do nothing.
Don't let the American people go another 20 years without health insurance reform in this country.
And this silly talk about having no ideas. I mean, we've heard that ad nauseum.
In about an hour, as Washington, D.C. contemplates another snow day, Democrats and Republicans lock themselves away for 6 hours with the cameras rolling to talk health care reform. They're calling it a summit meeting, like in the Cold War days, back when there were translators present. This time, not likely. Healthcare takes a trip to the mountaintop on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. It's Thursday, February 25th, and The Takeaway is the healthcare reform revolution of President Obama apparently will be televised for 6 hours today.
That's actually true. And you could sit through all 6 hours if you really wanted to. Let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. An hour from now, President Obama will try to revive his plan to overhaul healthcare. He and 22 influential lawmakers will lock themselves in a room at the Blair House in Washington for 6 hours to try and find common ground. And for good measure, as we said, it'll all be televised. White House spokesman Robert Gibbs tells CBS News this morning.
We want to hear again from Republicans and incorporate even more of the ideas that they have into the president's proposal. We know that if we do nothing, health care will continue to skyrocket.
You can hear the health care debate live at thetakeaway.org. It starts at 10 a.m. Eastern.
Well, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic, will be listening when everything gets started. Jonathan, good morning.
Good morning.
So, Jonathan, is this summit, pageant, Supreme Court of public opinion, whatever you want to call it, a sign of desperation on the part of the administration, or could it be the seed of a new initiative?
Actually, I think neither. I think this is a chance to finish the work on the comprehensive bill they've been spending more than a year working on already.
Well, we'll talk about what the constitutional implications of appealing to a court of public opinion is for the Obama administration and what's likely to come out of this summit in just a moment. Stay with us.
Members of Congress did press Toyota's CEO yesterday about when the automaker knew about the safety problems that have been linked to 34 deaths and what the company did about it. Akio Toyoda didn't respond to that directly, but he did apologize.
I am deeply sorry for any accident that Toyota drivers have experienced.
Toyota insisted the problem is not with the car's electronic systems. That's something that U.S. safety regulators dispute. SeaWorld has suspended its killer whale shows at all of its parks, including San Diego and San Antonio, after yesterday's death of a trainer in Orlando. SeaWorld's chief animal officer, Billy Hurley, says the whale involved in yesterday's attack will not be pulled down.
The concept of euthanasia or discarding the animal is not even considered.
This is the third time that this 30-year-old, 12,000-pound killer whale has been involved in a human death.
In Afghanistan, with the country's flag now flying over the city of Marja, U.S. forces say the neighboring province of Kandahar will be the next focus of the NATO offensive. NATO troops are still sweeping the city of Marja, though, clearing out pockets of resistance. At the Olympics, the U.S. men's hockey team beat Switzerland 2-0, while Canada ran over Russia 7-3. The U.S. took two bronze medals, including Aaron Pack in the women's bobsled.
It doesn't feel real yet because we don't have it in our hands, but I'm just so excited.
The U.S. team is excited. The medal count now stands at 28 for the U.S., Germany catching up with 24, Norway has 18, and we'll have another update on the games with the New York Times Olympics editor in just about 20 minutes. The number of new claims for unemployment benefits jumped unexpectedly last week. It's driving futures down, along with a mixed report on durable goods demand. The Dow gets underway at 10,374. The S&P opens at 1,105, and the NASDAQ opens probably negatively at 22.35. Coming up, we've got a new project from our home station, WNYC. We're looking at transportation around the country. Today, we talk about how the administration's work is going to affect commuters around the country. That's later on this hour.
And we continue our series, Frustration Nation. President Obama is holding this bipartisan health care summit. What do you think it'll take to get the two parties to get along?
This is John from KPAC. The only way to get the two parties to ever agree on anything is to abolish the two-party system.
Give us your take at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our website, thetakeaway.org. More about that healthcare summit in a moment.
Good morning, everyone. As the snow begins to fall in Washington, D.C., there are at least, by my count, 25, 26 or so people in Washington who will have a reason to stay indoors for 6 hours that has nothing whatsoever to do with the snow.
Absolutely nothing, unless one of them slips and breaks a bone.
Right, and God forbid that that would happen. Right. But at about 10 o'clock Eastern Time, the Healthcare Reform Summit convenes to live television cameras as the president gathers with prominent Democrats and Republicans to try to hammer out in public some sort of compromise on healthcare reform. Now, the Constitution makes no mention of summits, but I'm wondering, Darrell West, who's the vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, if this whole spectacle pageant summit, call it what you will, looks a little bit like Obama is convening a Supreme Court to overrule gridlock in the traditional Congress of the House of Representatives and the Senate. Darrell?
Well, he does hope to overturn gridlock because right now the two chambers are paralyzed and it's been very difficult to get the momentum to move forward. And I think the summit really provides an opportunity for Democrats to push the reset button. They've introduced some new elements. They have a proposal to give the federal government authority to block excessive insurance premiums. And I think Obama sees this as really his last chance to try and make this sale to the American public and to bring his own party together so they can actually pass health care reform.
Politically, Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic, we spoke to you right at the top of the hour. Obama looks really great on television. There's really no dispute about that. But translating that great look on TV into concrete legislation has been a real problem. How does this get us farther down the road?
Well, I think there's two chief goals here. Number one, I think this, everybody says they want bipartisanship. So he's saying, all right, let's give people bipartisanship. Let's put us both in the same room, talk about our ideas. Now, I think I suspect that we will discover that, in fact, the two parties just have very different ideas here and that the Republicans in particular are at their core not interested in doing health care reform. If that happens, then I think what he wants to do is he wants the American people to see that, and he wants to let the American people know, what is in this bill. Because even though the bill itself is unpopular, when you break it down and you tell people what's in it, remarkably, they like all the elements. So I think this is a chance to sit in front of the American people and say, look, this is what you said you wanted. I know it's been a messy process. I know you're turned off by the deal-making and all of that, but if we can pass this bill, we can actually do something to help you, and you won't have to worry about health care so much anymore.
Although implicitly, you're suggesting that the administration, having not done this up till now, maybe that's one of the key failings. Now, let's not talk about that for right this second, but Darrell West, governance studies, vice president, director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution. Now, you're aware of some of the disputes and arguments over actually how to frame this entire summit, even how it's going to actually look. How are some of those arguments between Republicans and Democrats about the seating of the chairs indicate the sets of priorities behind the scenes here?
Well, the little things help to set the agenda for the big things. And I think what Democrats really need to do is to play to their strong suit, because even though some elements of health care reform are not very popular, people actually don't like the status quo either. They don't like health insurance companies raising premiums. We've seen some health companies in California propose 25 to 30% increases. That's just simply unacceptable when inflation is running 2 to 3% nationally. They need to basically explain how their insurance changes are going to help the average American get rid of pre-existing conditions and make the plight of Americans better than it is under the current status quo.
Well, but does that mean they're arguing about who's going to use PowerPoint, who's not, who's going to have charts, who's not, who's going to be sitting near the podium, lectern or no lectern?
The biggest argument actually was over who would actually attend the summit. President Obama actually invited Republican Senator Olympia Snowe because her own Republican leadership had not invited her. She ended up declining. And then Republicans invited a Democrat, Congressman Bart Stupak, who has been the author of this controversial anti-abortion amendment.
Right. And so that indicates that clearly the bipartisan interest of the administration in talking to Olympia Snowe is one issue, and making sure that abortion question is in the debate is certainly an interest for the Republicans, right?
Absolutely, because each side understands the weaknesses of the opposition. So not only do they want to make their own case, they want to exploit some of the internal divisions that exist on the other side.
Jonathan Cohn, senior editor for The New Republic. Can I like hammer you with a possibly controversial premise here?
Please.
All right. The lesson supposedly of all administrations is when you get a mandate, you do the hard stuff first because you're not going to have much of a chance to do it later on in the administration when you get closer to re-election time and the congressional off-year elections, that sort of thing. Perhaps the lesson is just the obvious. It's just the opposite here, that if you take Clinton plus Obama, doing health care first is actually a huge mistake. What do you think about that?
Well, Clinton didn't do health care first, right? I mean, he did NAFTA, he did budget, and then he didn't even get to health care until very late in his first year. And there is this idea out there, if only Obama had talked more about jobs, he would be better able to do health care later. Well, what that tends to miss is the fact that, he did talk about jobs. He didn't do more about jobs because the Senate wouldn't let him do more about jobs.
Although there's an argument there. I mean, 17 Republicans crossed the line yesterday in the Senate vote on the jobs bill.
Well, funny, once they were able to break the filibuster to get the actual vote, 17 Republicans crossed the aisle. And I think there's a lesson about the Republican hypocrisy here, which is that they are trying to – you have senators voting to stop votes who say, no, we can't have this vote, we can't have this vote. And then when the bill actually comes up and they're actually going to be held accountable for that vote, they want to be on the winning side. They want to be the ones who helped to bring jobs to the American people. Substantively, I think that jobs bill we just passed is pretty small stuff. It's only $15 billion. It's a drop in the bucket. And that actually, gets back to what I was saying before, which is that, he did jobs and he couldn't do more on jobs because the Senate wouldn't do more on jobs.
So maybe this is a way of finding small stuff in health care and getting that passed. So, Jonathan Cohn, is this an infomercial or not? It sounds like you're saying it's not an infomercial.
I do not think so.
Darrell West, your view?
I agree. I think this is really the last opportunity to explain to the American public why we need to do this and why reforming health care is actually crucial for long-term economic competitiveness, because small businesses simply can't survive the current high cost of health care.
All right. So 6 hours perhaps well spent. Darrell West, Vice President and Director of Governance Studies at the Brookings Institution, and Jonathan Cohn, Senior Editor for The New Republic. Thanks so much. And at 15 minutes after the hour, 45 minutes away from that healthcare summit, we're going to check some other stories.
The number of new claims for unemployment benefits jumped unexpectedly by 22,000 last week. And speaking of jobs, Senate Democrats passed the major jobs bill yesterday that they were just talking about. Here's New York Senator Chuck Schumer.
It will do some good for the hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions who are looking desperately for work.
The bill would give businesses tax breaks if they hire the unemployed.
Here in New York, two more people allegedly connected to the plot to blow up the New York subway will appear in court today. Excuse me, and they're not strangling me at this point. The defendants are reputed to be friends of Najib Al-Azazi, who's already been sentenced to life in jail without parole. Finally, in Afghanistan, the Taliban stronghold of Marja is under government control today. But NATO spokesman Brigadier General Eric Tremblay says there's still plenty of work to do.
We will need a few more days to clear Marja and improve the security situation by separating the insurgent from the population.
And it looks like NATO's next target will be the neighboring province of Kandahar, a Taliban stronghold as well. France has confirmed that the suspected killers of a Hamas leader in Dubai last month used forged French passports. The French foreign ministry said three suspects had stolen the identity of French citizens. Meanwhile, police in Dubai have identified 26 suspects in that assassination, traveling on European and Australian passports. Israel has been widely blamed for the killing, but has denied any involvement. Let's look at some of the stories we're watching this morning. Coming up, new jobless claims out this morning. What story do they tell about the economy and unemployment? We talked to Kelly Evans for an answer. The statistics are really moving the markets. Futures are way down. She'll join us in just a few moments.
Hey, you want that to go?
We've got some takeouts on news stories that we're following this week, and we just have found out that jobless claims spiked unexpectedly last week by 22,000. Kelly Evans joins us to explain. She's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal. And Kelly, we understand that the spike in jobless claims is partly due to inclement weather on the eastern seaboard. Is that right?
That's right. I wouldn't say this is necessarily an unexpected increase, because I think as soon as the snowstorms proved to be as severe as they were a couple weeks ago, economists have kind of been on high alert to see how they might affect the data coming in. And I think... Excuse me. I think if you look this week, already we're getting an indication that it really has interfered. I mean, consumer confidence released on Tuesday really plunged across the board. There was no indication that had anything to do with the snow, but it did raise some eyebrows. And then you have today's report showing that jobless claims jumped last week. Now, the Labor Department says that's because they were still processing claims from a few weeks ago. You know, they were under the same backlog, you know, hard to get into the office that everyone else faced. And certainly there are some economists who say, you know, the jobs report that we get next month might not look too pretty. I mean, if you look at the past record, if you look at the snowstorm that hit in January 1996, you know, that had a drop in payrolls the following month of 200,000. So
wow.
for a month, there were all the fears of a double dip at that point sort of looked to be right on, until the following month showed a gain of 700,000 in the payroll report. So I think what this does is suggest the snowstorm did have an impact on the economy. Unfortunately, it comes at a time when we're really trying to get signs as to whether, you know, things are improving or not, and this makes that a lot more
difficult.
And we're
watching the numbers extremely carefully as the snow falls outside the window here in New York. Kelly Evans is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal.
And it's all moving the markets. Futures are still way down. Wall Street opens in about 7 minutes. For our next takeout, Jason Stallman comes back, Olympics editor for The New York Times. Jason, this is my first conversation with you during the Olympics here. I've been off for a little while, but I've been watching the games quite a bit. You're having a great time out there, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You know, here's my question for you, though. I've actually been watching a fair amount of curling, okay? And it seems to me that the sport of curling, very, very popular in Canada and some other places in the universe, has really benefited from NBC's, like, proliferation of 50,000 cameras and different angles and all these sort of digital boxes on the screen. Do you think they're betting that with enough digital sort of largesse, curling can be a hugely popular sport?
I think they're wise to the notion that curling is somewhat of a novelty. And even if people are watching it only to laugh at it and to make fun of it and question whether these are truly athletes, it does seem to resonate every 4 years. It's just so different than anything we're used to watching.
Well, it looks like a video game up there, and for that reason, it seems much more accessible. Explain the rules again.
Well, you know what? I tell you what, I think it's more enjoyable if you don't truly understand the rules, but it's, you know,
yeah,
it's not
true.
Unlike something like shuffleboard. They're sliding a stone down a sheet of ice, and they're, you know, aiming it toward a circular target. And it's a thinking man's game. It's a game of angles. And, you know, leave the questions of athleticism aside. It's fun to watch.
It is fun to watch. And who's favored for the gold?
Canada.
Yeah,
runaway favorite. And they have a really compelling skip or team leader. His name's Kevin Martin. They call him Kmart. And he absolutely does not look anything like what most people consider an Olympic athlete. 43 years old, balding, but he is rock star status in Canada.
Before we go, shifting to women's figure skating, can the Korean Kim Yuna, the favorite, who now has racked up such a huge score, be caught at this point?
Boy, it'll be really tough. You know, people are saying that she's going to have to fall down or something in order to be caught, but she's so superior that even if she falls, her technical components will probably make up for it. She could fall down and still win. However, her chief rival, Mao Asada of Japan, is planning to try to execute two triple axels. She's the first woman to execute a triple axel, one triple axel in the Olympics. She's going to try to pull off two in the free skate. If she does that, maybe it'll get close.
Well, maybe some suspense, but probably not much, but certainly a breathtaking skill and talent there on the ice with the Korean Kim Yuna. Jason Stallman, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jason, of course, is the Olympics editor for our partner, The New York Times, there in Vancouver, Canada.
And our last takeout is from you, and it's about technology. We talked about broadband internet yesterday and the government's plan to bring affordable high-speed hookups even to outlying rural areas. But Dwayne in the Detroit area called in to say the problem isn't just restricted to the countryside.
I have internet access, but only through satellite or by cellular broadband on USB connection to a laptop. And I'm just 15 minutes away from three major metropolitan areas. Right off of a major highway.
Dwayne, not many choices for internet there, but the story about internet access is that it's so dependent on where you live.
My name is Randy Oakham, and I got my laptop, and I just steal Wi-Fi. I don't even pay for it. I can sit in the middle of my living room and steal five different Wi-Fis. That's the way everyone should do it. There should be free. There should be Wi-Fi in every corner.
I applaud your initiative, Randy. I do want to point out one thing, though, is that while you're stealing the Wi-Fi, everyone can't steal it because at some point, somebody has to pay for the Wi-Fi that you take.
Although eventually, I think he's right. It probably will be
eventually.
Free. It's probably going to be free. It's going to be so ubiquitous. So, you know, I was away for about a week, and I found this really sad story. These two radio hosts who were forced to eat expired food.
That was an interesting story, John.
What were you guys thinking?
It was totally fine. That food was fine. That was really interesting.
And this is about to figure out if you need to trust expiration dates.
Well, it turns
produce.
Out they're arbitrary. There's no rules on how when to put these expiration dates on. The companies choose.
Well, I saw this comment from Ponto in Maryland. He writes, I once struggled over whether to buy shucked oysters from the bargain bin of a local store. It was very cheap, but I knew it might be a problem. I did buy them, and I made a superb oyster stew. I had no ill effects, but the tension of waiting out the oysters negated the value of the bargain. Have you waited out the food that you ate?
I feel fine.
Right. I don't know if I want to hear food poisoning roulette, although it is an intriguing sort of game. You can check it out at thetakeaway.org.
Coming up, we're going to hear about some people who are taking advantage of the earthquake that occurred in Haiti by trying to make money off of refugees who are trying to get temporary protected status in the United States. That's coming up in a few minutes. Also, we're going to talk transportation tomorrow, and we need you to be our feet on the street. We're going to be talking about gas prices and commuting costs and how that's affected the larger economy. Let us know your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Coming up, when the earthquake occurred in Haiti, some people rushed to help. Millions of people rushed to give money. A few people rushed to cash in on the crisis. We're going to talk about some scams that have surrounded the Haiti earthquake in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories that we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. In just about a half an hour, President Obama will mediate a televised debate between Democrats and Republicans on health care reform. Earlier this morning, we spoke to Daryl West from the Brookings Institution, who told us it's now or never for the president's bill.
Obama sees this as really his last chance to try and make this sale to the American public and to bring his own party together so they can actually pass health care reform.
But House Minority Whip Eric Cantor tells CBS News this morning.
We're going in because Republicans do care about improving health care for America and its families, and we just don't care for this bill of his.
You can hear the healthcare debate live at thetakeaway.org. It's due to start in just about a half an hour at 10 a.m. Eastern. With that as the backdrop, Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius is asking the heads of five major health insurance companies to meet with her next month. She wants them to explain why their premiums are on the rise.
Markets are falling off the cliff this morning. Futures are responding to a surprise increase in the number of weekly unemployment benefits that jumped unexpectedly last month. Also, a mixed demand for durable goods. The Dow is off 163 points at this hour. The Nasdaq, right at the open, off 32 points, and the S&P is off 14.77 points. And those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
After the Haiti earthquake, not everyone's response was charitable. A small minority decided to use it as an opportunity to make some money. Authorities in New York are investigating unscrupulous scam artists. They've been trying to provide phony legal services to Haitian immigrants. These are Haitian immigrants who want to take advantage of the United States government offer of a temporary protected status. With details, we've got the Manhattan District Attorney, Cyrus Vance Jr. He says his department has been getting complaints of scam artists charging Haitians exorbitant fees to apply for the immigration benefit. Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. How are you?
I'm doing well. Can you tell me, what's the scope of this? How many complaints has your office received, and what are the complaints detail?
Well, we received a number of complaints. I think the scope is enough to cause us concern, and particularly in light of the very difficult situation for the Haitian community. And the kinds of cases that are involved here are people who are preying upon Haitians because of their vulnerable situation. They include situations where someone pretends to be a lawyer who is not, someone who pretends to be a professional, like a government agent or real estate agent, offering to provide specific services, or a promise for a successful completion of documents, or simply someone who is unlicensed to practice law, engaging in the practice of law. The bottom line in all of this is that we have a very vulnerable group of people and people are taking advantage of them in that time of need by falsely representing either who they are or what they can do, all motivated by profit.
Who are these people who are pretending to be lawyers or government agents? Are they American citizens? Are they Haitian?
It can be a mix. It can be a mix. Some members of the community. I think we're finding in our complaints that it is a mix. It's not dependent on any one particular individual.
Okay, that's not limited to New York, certainly. In Massachusetts, the Catholic Charities of Boston have also been running legal clinics to help Haitian immigrants there avoid these kind of scams. Margene Perhote is the organization's Director of Refugee and Immigration Services. Good morning, Margene.
Good morning, Celeste.
So you have actually held 5 information sessions for Haitians. Have you gotten complaints from your clients?
Yes, Celeste, we have. And to reiterate what Attorney Vance was saying, we are seeing the very same things here in the Boston region. And our immigration legal clinics have been set up to hopefully prevent Haitians from being taken advantage of. But we do have folks coming in and saying, this person around the corner said that I could get my family here for $5,000, and, you know, is this possible? And so we are very fortunate that we've got an amazing group of immigration attorneys to help prevent vulnerable Haitians from being taken advantage of.
So give me an example of that story that you just said. Someone offers to bring someone's family here for $5,000, and perhaps this person raises $5,000 and pays it to the person. Then what happens?
Well, unfortunately, what happens right now, Celeste, is there's not a lot of provisions within the law to bring families here quickly. So this is happening to Haitians who really want to get their families off the streets in Port-au-Prince. And so they're desperate. And then they find out that once they go to Haiti to try to bring their family out, there's no legal mechanism to do so. So they've spent all this money, and now their family is still trapped in Haiti, and now they have $5,000 less to support the family back home.
Okay, Margene Perhote, she's the Director of Refugee and Immigration Services. You heard the district attorney from Manhattan say that there's a mix among the people, these scam artists, these con artists. Are you finding the same thing there in Boston, that they're both a mix of Haitians and American citizens that are doing this?
Exactly the same. It's really not different. And this problem has been plaguing the immigrant community for years. It's not new to the Haitian situation. So it's always something that we're keenly aware of, because we often, as Catholic Charities, receive the person after they've been scammed by these nefarious individuals.
Cyrus Vance, what is the legal jurisdiction here? If someone is a Haitian immigrant, what powers do you have to prosecute them for this kind of thing?
Well, first of all, I think just to follow up on the comments from Catholic Charities, this isn't just about prosecution. I think the goal of all of us here is about how to prevent these from occurring in the first place. And that's why we, in fact, several weeks ago, working with our local borough president, Catholic Charities, a number of providers held a Help for Haitians seminar and meeting on a Saturday, where we brought not only our community and the federal government, but the Catholic Charities and other providers to both alert people to what was going on, help the Haitians know how they can legitimately apply for temporary protected status, you know, and provide essentially wraparound services both to alert and prevent the crime and help those who are in need appropriately document their applications. What we have here is simply fraud and theft. The jurisdiction is really straightforward. People are being conned. They are being told that someone can deliver a product or an event that is false. Money is being paid to do it, and it's a scam. It's really a fairly straightforward situation of theft.
Okay, that's Cyrus Vance. He's the Manhattan District Attorney. Margene Perhote of the Catholic Charities of Boston. How much should it cost a Haitian immigrant to apply for temporary protected status?
The average filing fee that they have to pay to the U.S. government is $470. And with so many generous providers, such as the Catholic Charities, both here and in New York, many agencies are doing this for free. So encourage Haitians to look for the TPS clinics or workshops in their areas and get this service for free, because there's many, many dedicated attorneys who want to help Haitians and ensure that they're not being taken advantage of.
Okay, Margene Perhot is the Director of Refugee and Immigration Services for Catholic Charities of Boston. For Haitians who think they may have encountered some suspect immigration services, we have a link on our website to the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Just go to thetakeaway.org. Also, we have this new project that we're working on with our home station, WNYC. We're taking a look at transportation issues around the country. And today we're going to talk about how the administration's work could affect civil rights, how transportation becomes a civil rights issue around the country. That's later on this hour. And we're also looking for you to be our reporter on the ground. Tomorrow we're going to be talking about the hikes in gas prices and commuter trains. And we're wondering how that's affected you, because it has affected the foreclosure prices. How have you changed maybe the way you've lived or the way you've traveled because of gas rate hikes and commuting price increases? Let us know at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can send us an email to mytake@thetakeaway.org. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee. Yesterday afternoon, SeaWorld Orlando's largest killer whale dragged its trainer, Dawn Branchot, underwater, and she was drowned. Here's how Wayne Gillespie, a tourist at the park and a witness, described the scene.
We never saw, like, any biting or anything. It just looked like it was playing at first. Like, it never seemed to be, like, aggressively trying to hurt her in any way.
The killer whale was actually involved in two previous deaths. In 1999, it killed another person at the same park, and it was also one of three whales blamed for drowning a trainer at a different park 8 years earlier. Bianca Prieto is covering this story for the Orlando Sentinel. Bianca, you were at the park yesterday. What did you see, and what did park officials say in response to the incident?
Hi there. Yeah, I was at the park yesterday. I was one of the first reporters on the scene. And for a long while, the spokesman wouldn't tell us anything. They had us all corralled inside of a pavilion. When they finally did come out, the Orange County Sheriff's Office told us that, you know, the woman had slipped and fell into the waters and had been fatally injured. Dan Brown, someone with the SeaWorld, repeated the same thing and basically said, you know, that they were investigating everything, that they were looking into their policies and procedures, and wanted to find out how their quote-unquote family member had passed away yesterday.
This, as I said, this killer whale has been involved in two previous deaths. There's no actual conclusive evidence tying him to the deaths of two other people, but he was one of three whales that was blamed for the 1991 drowning of a trainer when he performed in Canada. And also in 1999, they found the body of someone who had snuck into the park, and the man was found dead lying across the whale's back, though they don't have any way of knowing exactly what happened there. Why was the animal still performing if we knew he had a violent past?
The animal is a valuable asset. We've been told that the animal is a valuable asset to the park and that it's had thousands of interactions with humans, with trainers, without an incident. Also, Tilly, the whale, was a father, and he would father many of the calves there, and he was used a lot for breeding.
So what happens to this whale now? We've already heard that they're not thinking of euthanasia or ridding themselves of the animal at all. Will the animal eventually be sent? Is there some kind of reserve where killer whales can be sent?
This morning, the Orlando Sentinel is definitely looking into that. We are trying to find out what SeaWorld is going to do with Tilly, what his future is, but nothing has been decided yet that we've been made aware of.
But it has been made clear that the whale would not be released into the wild.
That's what we're hearing, yes.
And what are animal rights activists in Florida saying about this?
Animal rights activists have long said that they don't think that these giant mammals should be kept in captivity and forced to perform, that these are wild animals that deserve to be out living in the ocean.
And killer whales don't have a dangerous reputation, actually, out in the wild.
That's right.
Okay, Bianca Prieto is a criminal justice reporter for the Orlando Sentinel. She's talking about an incident yesterday afternoon at SeaWorld Orlando. The largest killer whale there dragged trainer Dawn Branchot underwater. She was drowned there, and apparently the killer whale has been involved in two previous deaths, one in 1999 and one in 1991. Good morning. I'm Celeste Headlee, joined here again by John Hockenberry, who's come back after being away for a little while.
I came back.
Coming up, well, there's a new project with our home station, WNYC. We're looking at transportation around the country and how communities are affected by it. Today, we're looking at a funding coming out of the government, which asks not just that something be cost-effective, not just that a project be shovel-ready and ready to go, but also that it satisfy civil rights. policies out of the Obama White House. We're going to talk about that in a moment. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. In about 10 minutes, President Obama will mediate a televised debate between Democrats and Republicans on health care. You can hear that live at thetakeaway.org.
And one of the people that's going to be paying close attention to that health care summit is Savlon Hauser, a 27-year-old architect who has to pay for her own insurance. And good morning, Savlon.
Good morning.
So it's 6 hours long. That's a big chunk out of the day, but you're going to listen and watch?
I'm going to be checking blogs and getting updates as they come. I'll definitely be listening. It affects me, so.
Well, of course. And I guess there's a lot of concern as to whether this can actually accomplish anything. What do you think would be the most important thing for you to come out of this bipartisan summit?
Absolutely most important for me, and I think our country is the public option be salvaged from the wreckage. I don't know if how hopeful that is, but I think it's the only way to fundamentally shift our system from private enterprise, which doesn't work. We've tried it, to something that serves everyone.
Well, Savlon, I just give you a little piece of advice. I hope you have a sort of a plan B if your first choice doesn't come through today. But Savlon Hauser, we're going to check in with you tomorrow, 27-year-old architect, like many Americans watching the healthcare reform summit. Last a little economic news here. The number of new jobless claims jumped unexpectedly last week. Markets opened down on the news, and they're continuing down. Those are some of the stories that we're following this morning.
The Obama administration is changing the way that it awards funds for transportation projects. It's not just an effort to speed up the way that they are spending this pool of money, but there's also a change in vision on how the money is awarded, what projects get funded. Fair treatment, they say, includes fair access to good transportation across all communities. Here's Federal Transit Administrator Peter Raugoff.
An important part of our need to speed up this process involves quitting all the haggling between the federal government and these agencies about whether they follow and pass a very narrow criterion. Instead, we're going to recognize all of the benefits the transit projects provide, like environmental benefits, mobility benefits, benefits to low-income communities, and that will hopefully speed up our process in getting these projects off the ground.
Let's take a look at these different examples of how money is awarded for transit projects with David Schultz. He's the transportation reporter for WAMU in Washington, D.C. David, you just heard Peter Rogoff talk about three different things. He said environmental benefits, access benefits, and also low-income communities.
Right. That's a big change from the previous funding criteria that was established by the Bush administration. Earlier, I believe it was early this year, the Obama administration changed the funding criteria, and now they'll be looking at funding transportation projects that have livability benefits, and that includes economic development and environmental benefits towards economically distressed areas. And one example of that in the D.C. area is a bus grant that is going towards Prince George's County in Maryland and other areas throughout the D.C. region.
Well, explain this project to me, because it's a pretty small fish kind of project.
It is. It's relatively small. It's $15 million, which sounds like a lot, but it's in terms of transportation projects, it's relatively small. The money is going to go towards improving more than 2,600 bus stops, most of those in Prince George's County and economically distressed areas. It'll go towards better signage, new shelters, more benches, better lighting, and just it's a project that's sort of not necessarily designed to shorten commute times like would have been under the previous funding criteria, but it's just designed to get people on buses who wouldn't necessarily be riding buses otherwise.
And what kind of communities will this serve?
This will serve economically underdeveloped areas, areas with lots of African Americans, Latinos, Asians. It's definitely targeted towards those neighborhoods.
So people are seeing it as kind of a victory for low-income communities and minority communities in the D.C. area.
It is, and it's interesting to sort of contrast this with other projects that didn't get funding, like the K Street Busway. That's a project that would have created a dedicated bus lanes on K Street, but that did not get funding. So it's sort of interesting to contrast.
Well, it's interesting also how that particular thing mirrors other things going around in the country. That's David Schultz, transportation reporter for WAMU. And we can go now to Minnesota. Laura Yuen joins us. She's a St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. Good morning, Laura.
Good morning.
What is the project that you're getting funds for in Minneapolis?
Well, this is called the Central Corridor Project. It's an 11-mile light rail transit route connecting the downtowns of St. Paul and Minneapolis. And this announcement basically made it possible to include three extra stations along this line. And that issue has just been a huge hot-button issue for the communities who would be served by this line. Previously, the three extra stations would not be possible because it's kind of through the what's called the cost-effectiveness index out of skew. And
it was too expensive to make these lines that just serve these underserved communities.
That's right.
And they called it a civil rights concern because there were a lot of Asians and African Americans who said, look, we need bus service, I mean, light rail service like anyone else does.
Right. I mean, some folks felt that this line was just being built as kind of a pass-through for the rich, you know, commuters who are just trying to get from one city to the next.
Okay, and you're now getting almost $8 million for these three extra stations. That's Laura Yuen, a St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio. And we're going to go stop at one more place where this new policy on funding is making a difference, and that is in Oakland, California. Guillermo Mayor joins us. He's a senior staff attorney with Public Advocates, a nonprofit law firm and advocacy agency in Oakland, California. Good morning, Guillermo.
Good morning.
So explain to me the story of the BART Oakland Airport connector fight, the fight over this.
Sure. Well, this is the first time that the federal government pulls stimulus funding from a project because local officials did not take the necessary steps to ensure that the project was fair to low-income and minority populations. And at issue is a three-mile connector between the Oakland Airport and a BART station, or the Bay Area Rapid Transit District, which is the commuter rail service here in the San Francisco Bay Area. The project would replace an existing bus shuttle that connects the BART system to the airport with a $500 million rail link. And the concern over this project is that it does not provide any benefits to East Oakland residents that are overwhelmingly African-American, Latino, Asian, and low-income. What the project does is that it charges a $6 fare to get to the airport and back, so $12 round trip. It includes no intermediate stops so that East Oakland residents can access the many jobs along the three-mile route. And it really has not included their input. This project has significantly changed, and the community has been left out.
So this was another chance where you, I mean, this is another situation which you argued that they were creating a pass-through situation for higher-income people. You fought against this, and the Obama administration sided with you.
That's correct. It was unprecedented. You rarely see this kind of agency enforcement of civil rights, and it's great news for it signals a major shift in civil rights enforcement, not only at the Federal Transit Administration, but we think at other federal agencies.
All right. So you're going to get a service from the members, the residents of East Oakland, all the way to the airport, which will include stops along the way so they can get to their jobs.
Well, that's what we want is a project in the end that includes benefits for the community. Whether it ends up being a rail link or an improved bus link is yet to be known.
Okay, Guillermo Mayor is a senior staff attorney with Public Advocates, a nonprofit law firm and advocacy agency. We also spoke with Laura Yuen, St. Paul reporter for Minnesota Public Radio.
Our conversation on transportation is going to continue tomorrow. We're going to look at gas prices and commuting costs and how they're tied to the foreclosure crisis. But we really need your reporting to get that conversation started. Tell us how in your life increasing gas prices or bus fares or train ticket increases have hit your wallet. Give us the cost of your commute or the inflationary figure for your commute at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And we want your suggestions as to who had a good week and who had a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. We tally up everybody's luck this Friday, but we want to hear your take as well. And you know how to reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. And people on Wall Street not having a good week today, the Dow is down significantly, about 151 points. And with the President's Healthcare Summit starting later today, what should you know about it?
Each side understands the weaknesses of the opposition, so not only do they want to make their own case, they want to exploit some of the internal divisions that exist on the other side.
That's the Brookings Institution's Take. What's yours? Reach us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. The summit begins in just a moment.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.